From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome everyone to State of Belief. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, President of Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. On today's show, my conversation with one of the most important and prolific religion writers of our time, Karen Armstrong. Salon Magazine has called Karen a one-woman publishing industry. And it's true. She's the author of more than 20 books on religion, including the best-selling work, A History of God. She's also written biographies of Buddha and Muhammad. And she's penned her own memoirs about her time in a convent, a narrative as captivating as it is disturbing. And now Karen is back with yet another contribution to her already impressive list of books. The latest is called The Case for God. And now get this. In less than 400 pages, Karen adeptly leads readers through more than 3,000 years of history, from pre-modern times through the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, right up to the heated debate between atheists and fundamentalists today. All of this in an effort to show how people's understanding of God and concept of religion has changed. Many readers will be surprised to hear Karen's conclusions. As she explains, pre-modern Jews, Christian, and Muslims were quite different than their contemporary counterparts. The early monotheists did not read their scriptures literally. In fact, they understood the stories to be myths, parables, instruction for a moral life. On top of that, Karen says science and religion were not always enemies. Rather, they peacefully coexisted for most of history, even complemented one another. So how did we end up where we are today, with fundamentalists advocating for a literal reading of the Bible or Quran and science and religion seemingly at each other's throats? Well, best-selling author Karen Armstrong is with me now to answer those questions and to share so much more of her impressive knowledge. Karen's in the middle of a book tour, so I'm very thankful that once again, she has made time to be with us on State of Belief, and I gladly welcome her back to State of Belief.
It's a pleasure.
The book is entitled The Case for God, and you criticize many of the so-called new atheists like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins. I was just wondering, is this book meant to be read as a kind of defense of God against those who deny the existence of God?
That was perhaps the germ of the idea in my publisher's eyes. But I said to them I couldn't devote a whole book simply to refuting Dawkins and Hitchens. You know, that would be very limiting and depressing, I think, because I think I find their theology very, very limited. And, you know, and it's people have already done that quite ably. What was concerning me was that there, about the argument that followed in the wake of Dawkins and Hitchens, which was very aggressive for one thing, and also stressed things that I thought needed correcting. I just wanted to put another type, another way of looking at God on the table, a way that has is deeply rooted in the Christian tradition, the Jewish and the Muslim tradition, but which we've overlooked in our modern scientific society.
And that's probably, I'm guessing, why you also take to task religious fundamentalists for their literal approach to religion. So neither of these contemporary extremes gets it right.
Well, yeah, they are modern ways of dealing with religion, and religion always changes as society changes, because, you know, we are the people that we are, we think the way that we do, and our society is very literal-minded. We read texts in order to get clear information from these texts. And we must do that because we are sort of scientifically oriented, and science, reason, must relate very exactly to other aspects of life, to the external world, to the material world, to the world in which we live our daily lives. But there are other forms of knowledge which deal with ideas that cannot be answered clearly, quickly, and concisely. And in the pre-modern world, nobody read their scriptures simply as a literal account of events that had happened in the distant past.
So no one in the pre-modern world actually believed that Adam and Eve walked in the Garden of Eden. So how did the early monotheists understand scripture?
It was mythos, myth. Mm-hmm. Now, myth in our scientific society has a bad connotation. It simply means something that's not true. If a politician is asked about a peccadillo in his past life, he's likely to say it's a myth, that it just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But in the ancient world, myth was not intended to be literally true. It was trying to express the more elusive aspects of our experience. And it was, above all, a program for action. You didn't really understand the myth unless it was translated into action, either being ritually reenacted in some way or put into some kind of ethical action. Also, the Adam and Eve myth, for example, was very much expressing the spirituality attached to the first temple in Jerusalem, the temple built by King Solomon, which very much stressed the oneness of all things. As far as we know, the Temple of Solomon was a symbolic replica of the Garden of Eden. And so when worshippers visited it, the liturgy and the rituals helped them to enter that primal state of humanity where God had lived among Adam and Eve, where there was no, and people experienced a oneness where there was no distinction between good and evil and male or female, or animal and human, that people lived together in harmony. It was an experience of what they call shalom, often translated peace, but more accurately translated wholeness, completeness.
And I will just allude to this, though it's not the subject for today, for our listeners' sake, that you have an excellent book on myth and mythology, and for more of your thought on that, they can check that book.
Yes, it's called A Short History of Myth, and it is really very short, so it's quite accessible, really.
You point out something that is both interesting and I'm sure in some circles very controversial, that early Christians would not necessarily have believed Jesus to literally have been the Son of God. You say that even St. Paul the Evangelist called Jesus the Son of God, but when he did that, he wasn't making divine claims for him. In fact, early Christians would have been shocked by that assertion, you say.
Well,
why is
Jews,
that?
Most of the early Christians, Paul was a Jew, Jesus was a Jew, and that was an idea that didn't, wouldn't have occurred to them. Son of God in Jewish, in the Jewish scriptures means someone who is very close to God, who has been given a special mandate from God, a special task to be done by God, like a prophet or a king was called, one of the kings of Israel would always be called the Son of God, and he would be adopted by God on his coronation day. I think we find that in some of the Psalms. Psalm 2, for example. So, and also, Jesus made it clear that, yes, he called his Father, his God Father, but he said, you know, his disciples, everybody, you should call him the God Father too, our Father that art in heaven. Mm-hmm. And as St. Paul said, we can all become sons of God, all be in this special relationship with the divine.
Additionally, you point out, early Muslims did not understand the Quran to be a set doctrine. Rather, Islam was meant to be a way of life. Will you elaborate on that?
The Quran doesn't have much time for orthodox doctrines or enforced beliefs. It calls theological speculation zanna, which can be translated sort of self-indulgent guesswork. And the Quran says it makes people quarrelsome and stupidly sectarian. And the Quran is all about doing things, and that is what all religion is really about, what Christianity was like before the modern era. It wasn't something you believed, it was something you did. The Quran, the five pillars of the Quran, are all about going on pilgrimage, fasting during Ramadan, praying five times a day. And even the Shahada, where Muslims say, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. It's not a creed, as we would say, mm-hmm. understand it, in the Christian world. It's a program for action. I bear witness. That means that I have a mandate that every moment of my life will show that God, I only have one God, and that I'm not erecting other things like money or ambition or nationalism or another ideology onto the same level as God.
I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is writer Karen Armstrong, and we're talking about her new book, The Case for God. We've got a lot more to talk about. In fact, we're just getting started, so please don't go anywhere. We're coming right back after this break. Hello again, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. I'm speaking today with religion writer Karen Armstrong, whose new book, The Case for God, is an impressive history of the evolution of religion. Karen writes about the practices of early Jews, Muslims, and Christians, and she concludes that the early monotheists understood that religion was hard work. A surprising characterization, I think. I asked Karen to tell me what that work looked like.
Well, basically, most of it is all the world religions say the same thing. First, you have to sort of put yourself in a right disposition to God. Yoga, for example, was not just an aerobic exercise that you go in for a yoga class for half an hour a week, for example, in the gym. It was something you spent hours on every day, and it was about getting rid of all egotism, all selfishness, and all the taking the I out of our thinking. And rituals were designed to not just something you went through where you sang a couple of hymns, but you were expected to respond and think critically about the scriptures that you were listening to and get caught up in the liturgy. But above all, all the world religions insisted that you had to live compassionate lives, that you had constantly to dethrone yourself from the center of your world, put another there. Look into your own heart, discover what gives you pain, and refuse under any circumstance to inflict that pain on anybody else. And that's why all the major religions, develop their own version of what's been called the Golden Rule. Don't do to others what you would not like them to do to you. And you had to do that, not just doing one good deed for the day, as we often say. That's my good deed for the day. You had to do it, as Confucius said, all day and every day.
Regular listeners to State of Belief will remember, Karen, that the last time we talked extensively about your work on the Charter of Compassion,
yes,
which is an action that reflects just what you're talking about.
Well, yes, I got in 2008 a prize from the from TED conferences that said that gives you a wish for a better world. And I wanted to bring compassion back to the forefront of religious and moral life.
Karen, have modern religious people just got lazy?
I think, you know, a lot of people work quite hard, but they're not, you know, I think a lot of people think that they can go into religion, into a church, sing a few hymns, and then return to life. Ordinarily, and they don't find it at all amiss to say horrible things about other people or show impatience to other people, or they don't feel obliged to work for good conditions for everybody, as the Buddha said, to seek out, you know, for the happiness of the whole of humanity. That's a religious duty, really.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said, love your enemies, don't judge others. And that we have to do that in our daily lives, not just sort of hear it in church, nod piously, and then go back to our ordinary lives unscathed by the demands of our tradition. We don't get religion unless we do it. And it's like dancing or playing the piano. You can have a few lessons, but if you don't put yourself into it wholeheartedly, do your practice, work really hard for many years, you don't really get the essence of what religion is about.
I think some readers will be a bit shocked by how clearly you illustrate that up until around 1500, faith and science were not in conflict with one another. Even St. Augustine, one of the great Christian theologians, advocated for a principle of accommodation, which said that a scriptural text should be reinterpreted if it clashed with science. And he wasn't alone, was he?
No, that was the that was the general view of right up to the 16th century. So that right on the dawn of the scientific revolution, you have Calvin in his commentary on the first chapter of Genesis, saying that science and religion had different jobs to do. That if the new scientists were contradicting scripture, that was because scripture wasn't teaching us about science. As Calvin said, science is very pleasant and very useful, and it must not be impeded by some frantic persons who want to destroy what they cannot understand. He said, you know, for example, the Bible takes it for granted that the sun and moon are the largest of the heavenly bodies. But now we know, because of the new astronomy, Calvin said, that Saturn and Jupiter are much bigger than the moon. But, you know, the difference is that science isn't talking, or the scripture isn't talking about science. If you want to learn about astronomy and cosmology, he concluded, go and look elsewhere.
My guest today is Karen Armstrong, whose new book is called The Case for God. We've got to take another quick break, but there's a lot more to come, and Karen and I will continue to talk about this relationship between religion and science and how it's changed over time. Surprises ahead. That's when we come back, so don't go anywhere. This is State of Belief, and I'm speaking today with Karen Armstrong, author of the new book, The Case for God. Just before we went to break, Karen and I had started talking about the relationship between science and religion. As Karen points out in the book, many early Christian leaders like St. Augustine and John Calvin understood that science and religion were not in conflict. In fact, St. Augustine even advocated for a principle of accommodation which said that when science and religion did come into conflict, Scripture should be reinterpreted. That line of thinking, however, began to change, as you well know. It started with the work of Sir Isaac Newton. I asked Karen to talk a little bit about how Newton's understanding of the natural world forever altered the way we think about religion.
Well, this applies largely to the Christian world, of course. But Newton, when his towering genius uncovered this, discovered the workings of the solar system and the gravity that pulled the whole thing together, and thought he'd got an explanation for the solar system. And the Copernican system of all the planets revolving around the sun, he concluded that there had to be a God to who have started this off, and that he had found absolutely hard, clear, scientific proof that that God existed, that the Bible was right, that there was a being up there who was he says, very well skilled in mechanics and geometry.
How did we get from there to the split that we see dramatically around Darwin when a literal reading of Scripture began to conflict with science?
Well, you see, for the early scientists, for people like Descartes and Newton, God was absolutely essential to their physics. Their solar systems, they thought, didn't work without God. But it was only a few generations down the line before other scientists, Laplace, for example, could find an entirely natural explanation for the universe. And finally, of course, Darwin claimed that he'd found a natural explanation for life itself. But this wouldn't have mattered a jot if people had remembered St. Augustine and Calvin, who had said that Scripture isn't teaching us about science. But in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, Christians had become absolutely intoxicated with Newton's God, and the whole kind of scientific theology that supported it, and believed and had reduced God actually to a kind of fact, to a scientific explanation. They'd lost the older habits of thought that said, Scripture is allegorical, you don't translate it, understand it literally, and that if it clashes with science, well, you have to interpret the text allegorically. They'd lost that sense, and so when Darwin came along, they were left with completely without resource, and hence you have a great defensiveness. People could only think in terms of fact, and they felt if God wasn't a scientific fact, God could not exist, because during the 18th and 19th century, as science began to achieve such spectacular results, it was thought that science was the best way, the only way of arriving at truth.
I'm speaking with Karen Armstrong about her great new book, The Case for God. It's time for another quick break, but when we come back this time, we'll bring our conversation right up to the present moment, and you're not going to want to miss hearing what she's got to say about the present moment. So please stick around. This is State of Belief, and we're coming right back. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy, and I'm joined today by religion writer Karen Armstrong. Karen's latest book is called The Case for God, in which she traces the history of religion and people's understanding of God. Karen ends her book in present time with a critique of the so-called new atheists, people like Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins. Karen dubs this group, these are her words, secular fundamentalists. I ask her if that means that Hitchens, Dawkins, and Harris really aren't so different than the religious fundamentalists they rail against.
No, well, because atheism, historically, has always been not a blanket denial of the sacred itself, but a denial of a particular conception of God. And that was certainly true of in the early days of the history of Christians and Muslims, who were both called atheists by their pagan contemporaries, not because they didn't believe in God, but because their view of God was so different from the pagan idea that it seemed blasphemous. And Dawkins and Harris are Hitchens are mostly focused on fundamentalist Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that limits their critique, because Christianity is only one of very, very many Christian spiritualities. But they say that all religion is fundamentalist, and that people like me who are, sort of advocates of different kinds of faith, what they call moderate religion, are just as guilty as Osama bin Laden, because we're making something that should be expunged from the face of the universe acceptable.
Recently,
I find that an extreme view, to be honest. I don't think we can talk about expunging things or exterminating things after the terrible things we saw in the last century. It reflects the same kind of intolerance as some fundamentalists feel about the secular world.
Recently, I spoke with Harvey Cox, my friend at Harvard. I know you are probably aware of Harvey as well.
Yes.
And he says in his new book that fundamentalism is dying. It's on its way out. I've heard a lot of other people say that as well. Where I live, that doesn't seem to be true. But do you share that belief? And if you do, what does that mean for the future of the debates going on about religion and science?
Well, I haven't got a crystal ball in my room, so I can't really tell the future. But I don't. I think he's maybe being a bit sort of optimistic there. I think what we call fundamentalism is still there. I think it's a fact of 20th century life. And it is largely a response to the strains and stresses of the modern secular world.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other forms of religiosity, too, that are growing and developing throughout the world. There's a hunger, I think, for a kind of religion that isn't so intolerant and more open to other insights from other faiths and not so bound to a literal conception of religious truth. And I found that, I've been on tour now for nearly 3 weeks, and I found, you know, an immense interest in that. So I think we can't tell the future, but I think religion must start seriously addressing, if it's to fulfill its mandate, the major problems of our time. Environmental catastrophe, for example. This is a religious matter. We're supposed, Christians, Jews, and Muslims regard themselves as stewards of God's earth. And it's important that we grapple with this environmental crisis. And also, another major task of our time is to build a global community where people of all persuasions can live together in peace. And I think that unless we make the compassionate voice of religion a more vibrant voice in our time, so that we apply the golden rule globally and don't treat other nations, other peoples, as we would not like to be treated ourselves. I don't think, if we don't do this, I don't think we'll have a viable world to hand on to the next generation.
I know you're aware that polls in the United States, recent polls, see organized religion declining. On the extremes, more people might identify as either born-again evangelicals or atheists, but in the vast middle, there are a lot of people who no longer call themselves Catholic or Methodist, for example. Could it be that we're returning to an almost pre-modern understanding of religion where faith is without doctrine?
Let's say doctrine is there, but doctrine that will only be understood, the doctrines like Trinity or Incarnation were originally programs for action. As I try and show in my book, they were telling Christians how to behave, not how to think.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that people are just, And unless you do these doctrines, you don't understand what they're about, and they remain opaque, rather like the rules of a board game, which seem boring and incomprehensible and dull until you pick up the dice and start to play, and then everything falls into place. And I think a lot of people, because we've lost this sense of religious truth as being practically derived knowledge, something like dancing or swimming, something that you have to do and then you get it, I think people are saying, well, I just don't believe that, and are drifting away.
Does that relate, Karen? I know the New York Times review of this book recognizes that you call for a more mystic or philosophical approach to religion, but the reviewer says that most people are not mystics and philosophers, that many religious people want to believe in something literal, Jews to be the chosen people, Christians believe in the resurrection. How do you respond to that?
I don't mind if people want to believe things, but there is a test for all religions. This is not my test. This is the one that all the traditions themselves have devised, that if you... if your faith or your beliefs or your religious practice make you more compassionate, if they make you more open-hearted, then they're doing their job, because they're breaking down, they're helping you to break down that hard shell of ego and reach out to the holiness that we see in all other people. I can have faith that moves mountains, says St. Paul, but if I lack charity, it's worth nothing. And so if people, you know, but if your faith makes you hard and contemptuous, dismissive, even violent towards others, then you have to question whether or not you've got an idolatrous conception of God.
Karen, you and I have talked about religion on and off across the years. How has your own thinking about religion changed?
Well, for years I wanted nothing to do with religion at all. When I left my convent way back in the late 1960s, for about 13, 14 years, I just had wanted nothing more to do with religion. I felt exhausted by it. I felt failure. I found it its doctrines incredible. But then, after a series of career disasters, I started to be involved in making television programs about religion, which were initially rather very skeptical, rather Dawkins-esque, in fact. And I've told this story, of course, in The Spiral Staircase, my memoir. But gradually, as I became more involved with other religious traditions and started to study Judaism, Islam, Greek and Russian Orthodox Christianity, I recognized a whole lot of things that I hadn't understood about religion.
Did you learn something new writing The Case for God?
Oh, yes. And what I learned, you know, despite the New York Times review, was that in the pre-modern world, people were happy to hold themselves in an attitude of awe and wonder. That these spiritualities that I describe, and I try to show that in the book, were not by any means the for a small elite of monks. They were preached to the ordinary congregations in the church during Mass, teaching them to listen to Scripture and to realize that God lay, what we call God, lay beyond anything that we could say or know. And so I think that religion is often at its best when it helps to hold us in that attitude of awe and wonder, when it helps us to grapple with problems for which there are no easy answers, and often at its worst when it seeks to answer those questions definitively.
Karen, we'll end where we began. You're an amazing person, and I want to encourage you, please, to keep thinking and writing and speaking. You are a voice like no other, and also please keep coming back to talk with us on State of Belief.
I'd love to, and I would love all your listeners to just go into the website of the Charter for Compassion, which is being launched on the 12th of November, www.charterforcompassion.org.
I'm Welton Getty. It's such a delight to talk with Karen Armstrong. She will not compromise in her probing scholarship. She understands the importance of distinctions between religions as well as the emerging mandate for cooperation among religions. Karen's mind is filled with details and footnotes. But you heard it in the interview. Karen Armstrong gets it when it comes to the relevance of religion to non-religious people and the importance of religion in a society committed to pluralism and challenged by social problems. Repeatedly, Karen moves from back then to now, from belief to individual behavior and social action, and from the holy to the commonplace. In my opinion, Karen's aggressive movement toward contemporary relevance and prophetic challenge comes from a push that is resident at the center of all authentic religion. With a national infatuation with simplicity despite the complexity in our world, a passion for self-interests individually and corporately, contentiousness regarding quality health care for everybody, persistence in racist perspectives, senseless sniping between religion and science, and divisions between religions within religions and among religions and non-religious persons, we all could benefit from vital religions in our nation, stretching our minds, inspiring social vision, motivating bipartisan political action aimed at the common good, and teaching us to respect each other's dignity and work with each other cooperatively. Differences between new atheists, classic agnostics, common doubters, religious fundamentalists, and new initiatives amid old religious traditions must not prevent us, all of us, from working together to solve the most pressing issues of our time that continue at the expense of human hurts and the extinction of human lives. I am not concerned with how many angels can dance on the tip of a pen, but I am profoundly interested in knowing how religious and non-religious people can join together to snatch our universe away from ecological disaster, to still the guns that are firing all across the globe, to agree on values for the good of everybody, and to assure that every individual in this global village at least has enough to eat day by day and access to health care all of their days. Who says that can't happen? The truth is, we have not yet really tried to make it happen. Well, friends, that's our show for this week. You want to get in touch with us? I hope you do. Write to us. Go to stateofbelief.com and click on the Contact Us page. Or remember, we have a phone. You can call us 202-238-3291. That's our phone number, 202-238-3291. Tell us what you're thinking about these days, about the show or anything else that's going on. State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. You want to get more involved in the cause for religious liberty? Join us. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Now, we'll be back right here on State of Belief next week with more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Getty. That's State of Belief.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.